Do you find yourself getting so overwhelmed by the horror of the climate emergency that you just want to, well, forget all about it?
It does make sense that it's painful. It does make sense to need a break and respect and honor our feelings while understanding that this is our responsibility to look at this emergency and deal with it. Join the mass movement to reverse our disastrous course.
That's Margaret Klein Salomon, founder of the Climate Mobilization. We talk with her about her book, Facing the Climate Emergency, How to Transform Yourself with Climate Truth. But first, do animals appreciate beauty? Do animals have culture?
The whales learn a new song every year. Somehow these changes get innovated and then the innovations spread. It's kind of like every year they have a new hit song that everybody learns and everybody starts singing.
That's world-renowned ecologist and writer Carl Safina. He tells us about his new book, Becoming Wild: How Animal Cultures Raise Families, Create Beauty, and Achieve Peace. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. The last time we spoke with ecologist Carl Safina, it was about his book, Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. His new book, Becoming Wild, goes deeper into one aspect of what animals think and feel, culture. We think of what is learned from parents and one social group as constituting culture in the human world. But it's just as true among many of the other animals we share the planet with. Some species of whales have a babysitter culture, others a culture of song. Macaws are connoisseurs of beauty, and chimps learn how to be peacemakers. In Becoming Wild, Carl Safina explores the cultures of whales, birds, and chimps with reporting from deep within nature, alongside the individual creatures in their free living communities. Becoming Wild offers a privileged glimpse behind the curtain of life on Earth, and it helps to answer that most urgent of questions, who are we here with? I started out by asking Carl Safina what culture means when it's applied to non-human animals.
We think of that as a strictly human thing, but it turns out that there are quite a few animals, various mammals, various birds, even fish, possibly even some insects that have culture. And culture is the skills and behaviors and attractions that are learned and spread socially. They're not purely instinctive. They're not learned alone by trial and error. They're learned socially. And many of them are kind of arbitrary. You know, what kind of clothes we wear versus the clothing of another culture, music we have versus music of another culture. That's arbitrary. There's no right answer about clothes or hats or music. And it's a similar thing in these other animals that I write about.
Yeah, and you focus on whales, parrots, and chimpanzees, and you look at them within the context of what you call the three major themes of culture: identity and family, the implications of beauty, which was so interesting, and how social living creates tensions that culture has to soothe. So let's start with the whales. You ask the question, how does a whale, for example, how does a sperm whale find meaning in life? How does a sperm whale find meaning in life?
Right. Well, sperm whales are among the few, they're really the only one of the really large whales, what the so-called great whales, that exist in a permanent social group. Other whales have sometimes that will be found together, but those groups don't stay together for a long, long time. Young ones may stay with their mother for about a year or so, but sperm whales stay with their mothers for their entire lives. Their social organization is very similar to elephants, actually. And that makes sperm whales, well, it's one of the ways that sperm whales are unique. The thing about sperm whales is that most other whales give birth very far from where their food is. So they usually give birth in the, let's say, the Caribbean or in Hawaii, and then they migrate with their young to the feeding grounds of waters off New York and New England, or from Hawaii going to Alaska and British Columbia. The sperm whales give birth where their food is, but there's a catch, and the catch is that the food may be 1,000 feet or 2,000 feet down. They hunt large squid that hide in the frigid total blackness of those deep depths, and the baby sperm whales cannot follow. So the adults are down for about 50 minutes out of every hour. They have to go a couple of thousand feet down, then they have to hunt, and then they have to come back, and the babies are completely helpless at the surface. So the sperm whales have solved that by having a babysitter culture, permanent groups where if the mother is down, her sister, or maybe her mother, the baby's grandmother, will stay near the surface and babysit. And that makes the difference in their whole cultural setup. And it makes the families need to know always where their family members are. Their life is defined by who they are, and who they are is defined by who they're with. So they identify each other with a series of clicks that are like Morse code. They sound like fingernails tapping on a hard countertop, but they announce what family the whale is from, what individual is calling, and what clan the family belongs to. So those are three layers of social organization that the whales live by and that they communicate to one another. And that's how they stay together in the ocean over decades. And the ocean is a really, really vast place. And to wind up decades later right alongside the one that you've been with for all those years is not an accident. That takes effort, and it takes an awareness, conscious awareness of the goal of staying together and keeping the family together.
And talk a little bit more about these codas. I mean, they're really loud. They're like 200 decibels can be that loud, which seems unbelievable. Did you experience them?
Yeah. The thing is that they're that loud. Well, it's the whale hunting sonar that is really, really loud. But when you hear that, you're usually very far away, usually several thousand feet away, or you may be a couple of miles away, and you put a microphone over the side and you hear it through the headphones. It doesn't, well, first of all, the headphones have a volume control, but the other thing is at that distance, it doesn't come to you very loud. It's that loud at the whale's head where those sounds are coming from. But to hear a whale who is 2 miles away means that those sounds are actually vibrating several cubic miles of seawater, which is completely astonishing when you think about it. It's the loudest sound made by any living thing. And that's because they are operating in the vastness of the ocean, and also they're staying together in the vastness of the ocean.
And you describe kind of the mechanism, the biological mechanism by which sound is made. One of the points you make in the book is that culture, let's say these codas, which is a kind of language, I assume, is not only a product of evolution, but a driver of that. Is that true in this case?
Yeah, it is, because the one thing that is, one of the main ideas about evolution and one of the main ideas in Darwin's observation of natural selection is that for new species to form, there have to first be populations that get isolated from the main group, or the main group has to fracture into several different populations that get stranded on different islands or separated by a new mountain range or something like that. They have to be isolated from one another. And it never seemed to me like that was the full answer for all of the diversity that we see. I just couldn't believe that for many birds, for instance, that migrate over large areas of ocean and mingle in the treetops, that you could have so many different kinds of birds in the same region, especially very closely related ones, like the warblers that we have in the spring, and that they had all at one time been completely isolated. That it just seemed like there had to be a different answer. And there are lakes in Africa that have 1,000 species of the same family of fish in the same lake. But, you know, how did they get isolated if they're in the same lake? So I always thought something else must be going on. I've thought this since I was in graduate school more than 30 years ago, but I never could figure out what that other thing could be. And I think the other thing is some of the side effects of culture, or actually one of the direct effects of culture, which is that culture makes individuals form groups. Think of individuals, again, humans are a good example. Think of individuals who have the same language or who show the same flag or the same team uniform or the same religious insignia or even listen to the same music. Those people tend to come together and they form groups. This is true with the sperm whales, for instance, that we're talking about. They form clans based on the way that they travel and hunt. And this is different from other sperm whale clans that travel and hunt differently. They know through their codas which clan they belong to, and the individuals group together in that clan. But the clans avoid each other. So you have individuals who come together in groups and then groups that avoid each other. And if you look deeply into the scientific literature on the way this has been shown to work in quite a few other species of birds and fish and a couple of mammals, the fact that the groups avoid each other starts to sort of harden, and they avoid each other for actually thousands of years and begin to, in many cases, not in all cases, they begin to evolve along different trajectories. That, oddly enough, even though we're talking about sperm whales and they're a good example of how individuals form groups and the groups avoid each other, the male sperm whales travel around the different groups and they keep those groups genetically mixed. So they're not evolving biologically in different trajectories. They have their different cultures that they keep separate. But when you have some other whales, the killer whales especially, they're different groups, which are called communities. Well, they have different layers. They have pods, they have communities. The communities totally avoid one another. And a lot of what their culture is based on is the skills it takes to catch certain very specific foods. So you have some killer whales or orca whales that are fish eaters that specialize on salmon, let's say, in the Pacific Northwest. And then you have others in the Pacific Northwest that specialize in eating marine mammals, especially seals and sea lions. It takes a very different skill set to catch a seal than it does to catch salmon. For catching salmon, you want to be in a big noisy group that will scare the fish together and group them up so that you can basically attack them in a group. But for mammals, which can hear that kind of noise and respond to it, you want to be very, very stealthy and quiet. Now, you can't mix those two things. You can't have fish eaters trying to hunt mammals because they'll spoil the whole hunt by being noisy. And the mammal hunters eat prey that's much, much bigger than a salmon. So they, by being apart for thousands of years, and their only really big difference is the the kind of food that they learn to hunt, they've actually started evolving some differences. The mammal hunters have larger teeth and stronger jaws. They have these different behaviors. And the different skills reinforce this isolation. And eventually, they will probably be obviously different species. But right now, I would say they actually fit the definition of species. A species is a group of individuals that freely interbreed when they meet during, you know, normal life. And when killer whale communities meet a different killer whale community, they avoid each other. They do not interbreed at all. So to me, that is the definition of species, and I think they're already there. Those are the evolutionary implications of culture.
That's so interesting. If you're just joining us, this is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with world-renowned ecologist and author Carl Safina about his new book, Becoming Wild. Now, you also talk about ways in which things that people might have thought were instinct are actually culture because they change historically. For example, you talk about the restructuring of the social organization of whales, say from smaller groups to larger groups, during the whaling period, and now they are again smaller. So what did whaling have to do with changing the culture of whales?
Well, you know, there's safety in numbers. And, well, those whales know that the sea can be a dangerous place. They have to defend themselves when killer whales show up because they are vulnerable to killer whale attacks, and they have skills to ward off and thwart killer whales as a group. So they do understand danger, and they do understand when they are under attack, and they communicate that over many miles. If killer whales show up near a group of whales in a short period of time, very often there are more and more sperm whales coming into their aid because they're sending out these alarms that tell the other whales that can hear them miles away, like up to about 7 miles away. Think of how loud that is underwater, that they're being attacked. So they come to their aid. So they understand all of that because that's the situation that they've always faced. And then when humans started chasing them with ships, they noted, the humans started noticing that within a relatively short period of time, I mean, a few years, that instead of seeing whales here and there, they would not see any whales for long stretches of time and distance. And then suddenly they would come upon very large groups of whales. They had apparently grouped together, knowing that there was a new danger and knowing that there's safety in numbers. And they had apparently started traveling in much, much larger groups. And now that those whales, we're talking about sperm whales again and their particular social structure, now that they are essentially not hunted anymore by humans, they have seemed to revert to the kind of social organization that they originally had something like 200 years ago when people first started to really chase them.
Talking about whales not being hunted anymore or not being hunted anywhere near as much as they were, that really changed when us humans learned about the male humpback whale song, which is a very interesting cultural change that we evolved in response to a cultural artifact of the humpback whale. Talk about the song of the humpback whale. That's also changed sometimes. And so talk about how that's a culture and how it is used as culture and kind of the connection to art, because it seems that it is really a form of artistry.
Yeah, well, the male humpback whales sing, and this is something that they are born with a capacity to do, that as they mature, they have a capacity to sing. So that's an inborn capacity. But what they sing is entirely learned, very similar to humans' capacity for music. And the amazing thing about the songs of humpback whales, well, one of the amazing things is that all the males in each ocean sing the same song, but the song in each ocean differs from the song in every other ocean. So the whales learn a new song every year. Somehow these changes get innovated and then the innovations spread. It's kind of like every year they have a new hit song that everybody learns and everybody starts singing. And, you know, because it's learned and because it is spread socially, it's, you know, the most striking cultural aspect of humpback whales. And as you mentioned, when people first heard it, which was really in the 70s, well, you know, people didn't understand that these whales were singing or making any sounds until the late 50s, when people listening for enemy submarines were hearing these very strange and haunting callings, and they didn't know where they were coming from. But eventually, through the 60s, people figured it out. And then a couple of scientists, Roger Payne and Scott McVeigh, figured out that they were all singing the same song. It's a very complicated song. You have to listen for a long time to realize that it's the same thing and it comes around again and again because they tend to sing it over and over. And then that was recorded, and the recording was put into every issue of National Geographic magazine. I forget what year it was, sometime in the early 70s. That's the largest printing of a audio recording in history. And when people heard how haunting and beautiful it sounded, it totally changed their impression of what a whale is. People at that time, you know, there was no whale watching, and almost nobody had ever seen a whale, or if anybody saw a whale, it was somewhere in the distance and it disappeared. So people always thought whales are these big ocean animals. They must be very dangerous. All these things that are not true about them. And then suddenly here they are singing these haunting refrains to each other. And it completely changed people's view of them from seeing them as nothing but a resource of fat that could be used in products like margarine to something that was ethereal and almost spiritual that helped to catalyze the environmental movement of the 70s and went a very long way toward eventually getting essentially all commercial whaling banned around the world, although there still are, unfortunately, some pockets of that.
Yeah, and we don't have a whole lot of time left, but I want to go to another species, and that is macaws, who you also studied. And the thing you really zeroed in on this is beauty, although we have just talked about the beauty of the songs of the humpback whale. But macaws are stunningly beautiful. We think they're beautiful, but evidently they must also think that they're beautiful. So talk a little bit about how puzzling through the notion of beauty as a cultural phenomenon for the macaws led you to much larger questions about the role of beauty in all species.
Yeah, well, in birds, well, stick with birds right now because we'll talk about the macaws, and birds are a good example of this. In birds, the males are usually very colorful and the females are usually very camouflaged. Well, that makes sense that females are sitting on nests from time to time and you just want to be camouflaged in general because it's a dangerous world out there. But if that's the case, why is it that males stand out so much? They're not only very colorful, but they're the ones that are singing usually and drawing a lot of attention to themselves, both very dangerous kinds of things. How did this happen? Well, Darwin, who came up with the idea of natural selection, understood that the camouflage of females could be explained by natural selection. If you were not camouflaged, you would not last very long. So, you know, the environment was selecting for camouflage, but he realized that his great idea could not explain why males would be colorful and drawing attention to themselves. Why do they draw attention to themselves? Mostly to attract females or to compete with other males for mates and for territory to breed in. And watching them display and watching females watch males display, he realized that the exertions of the males to attract females and call attention to themselves were being driven by the females being very choosy about who they would mate with. And he called this kind of selection, which could explain very extravagant, very colorful males, he called that sexual selection. It's not as well known as natural selection, but in a way, it's a much more amazing idea. And in another way, it's kind of a more dangerous sort of an idea, because what it really means is that much of the beauty in the animal world has been created by the arbitrary desires of females. Females have driven the evolution of much of what we see as beautiful in the natural world by their insistence on a certain look and choosing the males that have more of that look than the competing males and pushing it to extremes, like peacock tails, for instance. So, you know, this is not an idea that we kind of carry around in our heads every day. But when you start looking and understanding about what is going on with that, you realize this really amazing thing, which is that females are selecting males based on an arbitrary idea of what is beautiful. It's as arbitrary with them from one species to the next as our ideas of beauty are arbitrary from one culture to the next.
Yet we find beautiful the same thing that birds find beautiful, or we find flowers beautiful, even though they're not really seeking to attract us. So we must have the same general preferences that bees or other pollinators do. I mean, it almost seems as if there is a common ground of agreement for what is beautiful among beings.
Well, yeah, and that, I think, is one of the most, I mean, it's sort of such a mysterious thing that it's almost a mystical thing, that these things that are designed to be attractive only for other species, flowers are designed, well, they evolved to attract insects and birds and bats that pollinate them. We don't pollinate flowers, so we don't have any reason to find flowers or their scent attractive. We don't have a reason to find bird song attractive. We don't even have a reason to find the marking patterns of birds or colored fish or things like that attractive. And yet we do, as though beauty in the world has a kind of a universality to it. So if you think about what in the world does that even mean, you have to first ask, well, what is beauty? And beauty is not a property of anything. Beauty is a perception that is created by a mind. What comes to us is only the signals of, let's say it's a bird, you know, and it's a bird that has colors and long feathers and things like that. Well, those are just signals that come into our brain. Our brain interprets those things as beautiful. It's the capacity of our mind that makes it beautiful. It's beauty is only our experience of it. So why would we have a capacity for beauty, for this experience of beauty, and why would it be so universal? And I think, you know, to sort of skip to the end of a longer argument that I have in the book with some of the evidence of why I think so, I think that if you think of how hard it is to survive and how much work life takes, you know, just staying alive is maybe not worth the effort and the time it takes. And beauty, in a sense, gives us a reason to be alive, to perceive the world as beautiful gives us a reason to love being alive enough to want to do what it takes to stay alive.
So that really does kind of say, you know, why we need art, because art is about beauty. It's about perception, certainly about culture. I mean, it's what knits us together and makes life worth living. Is that too far-fetched to say?
No, I think it's I think it's not far-fetched. I think it's very closely fetched. I mean, why we don't sing and dance and paint and things like that because in any way we have to do that to stay alive from one day to another. We do it because it makes staying alive from one day to another much more worthwhile. It helps us to enjoy life. And another implication of that is, you know, imagine a world in which there is no art, there is no music, there is no singing, clothes all look like brown smocks. And that, as grim as that would be, that is kind of what we are doing to the world itself when we destroy these beautiful wild places and we send species on the way to extinction. We're robbing the richness and beauty that took millions of years of the choosings of living things to create.
That is, of course, the most important thing that we have to remember, both our commonality with these beings, how we need them, and what we are doing to them, and therefore our own world. And Carl Safina, as always, your books really bring that lesson into sharp relief for us, and also in such a stunningly beautifully written way, including this book, Becoming Wild, How Animal Cultures Raise Families, Create Beauty, and Achieve Peace. Of course, we didn't get to the chimpanzees. We'll have to leave that for our listeners to pick up your book and find out about that last part, Achieving Peace. Thank you so much for talking with us here.
Oh, Francesca, it's always a great honor to be on your show and always wonderful to speak with you. Thank you so much for having me.
Carl Safina. Safina is founder of the environmental advocacy organization, the Safina Center. His books include Beyond Words and The View from Lazy Point. Go to writersvoice.net to hear our interviews with him about those books. Also, you'll find a link there to an excerpt from his new book, Becoming Wild. Next up, confronting climate grief and turning it into climate action. Stay tuned after the break. That was a humpback whale song recorded from the depths of Monterey Bay in California. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter at writersvoice.net. Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. And like us on Facebook at Writer's Voice with Francesca Rhiannon, or find us on Twitter at Writer's Voice. Imagine there's a fire in your house. What do you do? You do whatever you can to try to put out the fire or exit the house. You make a plan of action. You enter emergency mode. Those are the words of Margaret Klein Salomon in an article she wrote last year entitled, "With a Planet on Fire, This is What It Means to Enter Emergency Mode." So what if you're so paralyzed by despair at the climate crisis that you just ignore it because it's too overwhelming to face? Well, says Salomon, deal with it. You wouldn't be paralyzed if your house were on fire, and it's no time to be paralyzed while our planet is on fire. But Salomon, a former clinical psychologist, also understands your pain. She feels it too. Her new book, Facing the Climate Emergency, is a kind of self-help manual to confront the despair and turn it into joyous action. That's what happened to her when Hurricane Sandy slapped her in the face with climate reality, and she decided to do something about it. She founded the Climate Mobilization, a grassroots environmental advocacy group working toward large-scale political action against global warming. Well, Margaret Klein Salomon, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
In this book, Facing the Climate Emergency, you start out with, we are in pain. What are the roots of that pain? Describe it. How does that work?
Obviously, there's many levels of pain that individuals are feeling, you know, personal, economic, and so forth. But I'm adding a new dimension to thinking about that based on the understanding that we are rapidly and in an accelerating way destroying the atmosphere and ecosystems, you know, life of this planet, and endangering ourselves and our families and the whole human family. And that act and living in a system that does that, of course, is tremendously painful.
And painful because we all know it, whether we acknowledge that or not. Is that right?
Yes. I can't necessarily say all. But yeah, I mean, look out your window. Was this winter normal? Are weather conditions where you are, climatic conditions, the ones that you grew up with? I mean, for a long time, scientists have been predicting dangerous climate change, but we don't need to rely on that. I mean, and of course, we should have listened to them decades ago, but people can see it with their own eyes at this point.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it is just below the surface in some ways. I recall several months ago, I was standing in a line in a store, and I was reading something on my phone that was about the accelerating destruction of our ecosystems and the collapse of ecosystems, and I just kind of gasped, and two women in the line ahead of me turned around, and I just explained to them, I said, you know, we just don't have much time left, and the first reaction was to poo-poo the idea, you know, oh, climate change, that's not going to happen for a long time, you know. And I said, well, just look around you. You know, I basically asked them the questions that you just asked me. And a whole different feeling came over them immediately. It was like giving them the permission to actually entertain the notions that what's happening is what they see is happening. So I really think it is just below the surface. And your book really does address getting to that. And so you go through a number of steps that I think are really important. Step one, face the truth. You know, you tackle the idea, which I think is pretty common in the climate movement, that you can't really tell people the truth because they'll freak out and then they'll despair and they'll do nothing. So what's wrong with that approach? And why do you say step up to facing the truth boldly is really the way to go?
Yeah, I consider that idea that people can't handle the truth and we shouldn't possibly make them feel afraid to be probably the single worst idea in the world. I think it's really set the climate movement back tremendously, and I'm so thankful that some organizations are discarding that conventional wisdom. I think there's a lot of things to say about it. One is the idea that the information will turn people off is kind of a bizarre construction, because people are off. Why are we afraid of turning people off? We need to be focused on turning people on and understanding that the vast majority of people are currently off. So that's one thing. But there's just a basic misunderstanding that, as you hear in climate circles, that fear doesn't work as a motivator, which is truly on its face just a ridiculous assertion. Fear is perhaps the most basic motivator, not just for humans, but for all animals. Fear is literally how we translate a perception of danger into self-protective action. If our ancestors didn't feel fear, they would have stood and watched as predators approached them rather than protecting themselves. So by saying somehow fear is taboo, it's seriously a shocking strategic error. And finally, what do you do if you decide that you can't scare people, but the truth is inherently terrifying? You don't tell the whole truth. And I think that's a real violation of the public trust, as well as I've said, terrible strategic decision.
Right. I think a lot of people feel that, you know, if they know the truth, they're going to just try to distract themselves. And I think you know that as well. And I know it as well, too. I mean, I still, when I see climate news that is dire, and I just read something, I believe it was yesterday, of that ecosystems collapse all of a sudden, and many of ours are going to collapse all of a sudden in about 10 years. So that's a pretty short horizon. It took me a while to be able to actually read that article, because I had to steel myself for that. So how do you deal with the desire to say, yeah, I know, but I can't bear it right now. I'm too stressed. I'm going to turn it off.
Okay. And when are you going to turn it back on? I think that it is hard, and we need to be compassionate with ourselves. It does make sense that it's painful. It does make sense to need a break and to respect and honor our feelings, while understanding that this is our responsibility to look at this emergency and deal with it. Join the mass movement to reverse our disastrous course.
Which is exactly what you did. Now, if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Margaret Klein Salomon about her book, Facing the Climate Emergency, How to Transform Yourself with Climate Truth. So you started the climate mobilization. Give us a quick description of it.
The climate mobilization is an advocacy organization and organizing operation that advocates a whole society emergency speed mobilization for zero emissions and to restore ecosystems. So we have our hands in a lot of different areas. We develop policies and visioning for what we actually need. We have a victory plan that outlines the most aggressive policy program that we're aware of, that this is what the government would do if they actually treated the climate like the existential emergency that it is. Our most successful campaign and our organizing focus is the Climate Emergency Campaign. Because of our work and the work of our partners, over 1,400 governments around the world have declared a climate emergency. Most of those are local governments, including New York, Paris, Barcelona. But there's also national governments, and the entire EU has declared a climate emergency, including Bangladesh, Canada, the European Union. So it's a concept that truly went viral and very much helped contribute to the fact that media mentions of climate emergency went up 10,000% in 2019, and it was named Oxford English Dictionary's Word of the Year. So we've really done a successful intervention into language and how we frame this situation, but also in many of these cities and governments, though not all, are really using the emergency declaration as a jumping off point for, let's say, a different kind of climate response. So, for example, Berkeley, California declared a climate emergency and then banned gas hookups in new construction, which was then now 20 cities, mainly in California, have adopted that regulation as well. And Ann Arbor, Michigan declared a climate emergency and then announced a $1 billion plan to reach zero emissions by 2030, which is quite something for a town the size of Ann Arbor, which happens to be my hometown. So that was especially meaningful. And then the other part of our work and kind of what it rests on is this psychological approach. This book is part of our programming and my speaking around that, and proceeds from the book go to the organization, you know, with the goal of trying to really bring emotions into the climate discussion where they absolutely belong.
And so let's talk about those emotions. Step two in your plan on how to transform oneself with climate truth is to welcome fear, grief, and other painful feelings. Now, I know this is the stage I'm stuck at. Talk about this step. You have a rubric called RAIN. Explain what that is and tell us how this can help us to take this step two.
So the idea is the same in psychotherapy and in mindfulness meditation, that the best and most healthy way to approach our feelings is through non-judgmental and compassionate curiosity and exploration. And that is so different from what most people do. You know, most people say, oh, I feel angry about something, so therefore I feel guilty because I feel angry. Or I feel sad, but other people have it worse, so I shouldn't feel that way, right? Anytime somebody says, that's why I shouldn't feel that way, or I feel I'm a bad person for feeling that, we need to liberate ourselves from that mentality and recognize that the only thing that has moral weight is our actions. And that in the realm of our thoughts and feelings, we should aim to expand as much as possible. So if you're feeling, for example, enraged about the climate or in despair about the climate, that first of all, those feelings are absolutely fine because all feelings are fine, but also that they come from a really important part of you. A part of you that is worth honoring, that to not feel grief and sadness and pain at what is happening in our world is to be disconnected from each other and from life. And that the pain that we feel embodies our connection.
I love how you say that. And it also connects to another very important idea that undergirds this book, Margaret Klein Solomon, Facing the Climate Emergency. And that is, you know, you counter that neoliberal, individualistic notion that society doesn't exist, as Margaret Thatcher said, you know, we're all just atomistic individuals bouncing off each other. I mean, I think we know, you know, most people are waking up, or many people are waking up to the fact that we're all in this together by this pandemic, which I think is actually kind of a dress rehearsal for how, you know, we can think about climate change. And I'd love to have you comment on that. But this notion that we must move to a stance of social solidarity.
Yeah. As they say on the TV show Lost, live together, die alone, that the idea that we're all in it for ourselves, so we're all going to pursue our own short-term, like hedonistic desires separately from each other. It's, you know, we've only got about, I don't know, 10 years or something, but years left of even having that as an option. We have to understand that this world, this neoliberal system, is finished. It is in its absolute last gasps. And our options are to transform or collapse.
And so on to step three, actually, which I think is also a wonderful chapter. Reimagine your life story. Part of reimagining the life story is joining that sense of the collective, of how we are stewards of the planet. So tell us about step three.
So once you realize that the future that you've been hoping for and planning for and trusting in is gone, that kind of continuity of, you know, society and progress and these kinds of ideas just continuing, once you realize that's just not an option anymore, and I talk about grieving the future that you thought you had, it opens up space. It creates the possibility of, okay, what I thought I was heading towards is not going to happen, but I have things to offer. I have skills and experiences and energy and relationships. And so I challenge the reader to think, what if actually this is why you're here? What if your life was leading up to this moment and this crisis, and that your job, your mission is to step into that role, that, you know, heroic mindset of having a mission that comes first.
Yes. And you also end this chapter on step three, reimagining your life story, with declaring that you have an ongoing relationship with the force on earth that wants to live. And I love that, because I sense that force really does exist. It's a real thing. And to think of it is to know that you are not fighting alone.
Yeah, absolutely. As long as I believe people have been writing and imagining our world, there's been a concept of good and evil. And the idea, like, what is good and what is evil? What does that really mean? And to me, you know, borrowing from Eric Fromm, it's what is good, what is morally good, is anything that nurtures and restores and allows life, human and otherwise, to thrive. And what is evil is anything that destroys life and hampers life. And our economic system at this point is like the ultimate life destroyer. So yeah, that the spiritual sense of, I guess, being connected in the mission to protect life, and the understanding that there is something, and very difficult to put words to, but something that is helping us and guiding us and calling us. I mean, basically with the humility that there are so much of our reality is still outside of our awareness and our knowledge. Yeah, I'm really describing what I feel and what I see, but that is a longing and really a birthright. It's inside of us, the connectedness to all life and the desire to protect it and help it thrive, as well as thriving ourselves. So it's not about adding something that's not there. It's about connecting with a force that is already inside of you.
And outside of you as well. I think James Lovelock gave it the name Gaia, you know, which is the consciousness of the planetary ecosystem to live and to thrive.
Yeah, maybe that's right. Maybe it's a part of Gaia.
So we don't have a lot of time left to go through the next two steps, but I will mention them, and we'll do a little bit on step five. Step four is understand and enter the emergency mode, and I think we've really touched on this, that we don't really have any time to lose. The fifth one is join the climate movement. So on this week of Earth Day, what would you advise people to do beyond reading your wonderful book, Facing the Climate Emergency, and going to climate mobilization? What are some specific things or range of things that you think that people should do?
This is the only thing I tell every person to do, which is talk about it. Talk to everyone. Talk to all your friends and family and colleagues about the climate emergency, and do that in an emotional, personal, moral way, rather than going to see them with a PowerPoint about parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere. Though you can drop a few stats if that's your thing. So set up calls. Say, hey, I'd love to talk to you about the climate emergency. Let's talk. And it has so many benefits of breaking the social silence, what Yale Climate Psychology Department calls the spiral of silence around climate, which is people don't talk about it because people don't talk about it. So it's, a social taboo. So it's intervening in that. It's raising someone's consciousness. And it's also good for your relationships. If you are scared and grieving and angry about what is happening, as you absolutely have every right to be, why shouldn't your family and friends and colleagues know how you feel and what's in your heart? So that's really, I think, a great place to start. I think that what comes after that, in terms of joining organizations, getting together with others to contribute to mass movements and collective change, is so individualist, like idiosyncratic. So that's, what I really do in step five, is to try to really think through what the movement needs and where different skills and people. So, for example, do you have school-aged children? If so, think about getting involved with a climate strike. Are you willing to get arrested? If so, think about joining Extinction Rebellion. Do you have skills that you sell to clients, like massage therapy, for example? Give this for free or for a reduced rate to organizers. Movements are really multi-layered. And so there's no easy answer. There's no one answer for what should I do. It's rather, what should you do is take very seriously that question and figure out what's going on locally, figure out what's going on nationally, and start finding your place in the movement. But you do that through a process of checking things out and getting involved. It's a hands-on process. You should start out going and checking it out and seeing what they're doing, and if you agree, and finding ways to plug in, and it goes from there.
Well, that is great advice. And your book, Margaret Klein Solomon, Facing the Climate Emergency, How to Transform Yourself with Climate Truth, is an indispensable guide to doing that.
Thank you for reading and for feeling it, and for this conversation.
Margaret Klein Solomon. Go to writersvoice.net for links to the climate mobilization as well as other climate groups. There's also a link to an open letter to Congress to enact a green stimulus to rebuild our economy that you can sign on to. And you can also find climate legislation and policy initiatives on a wide range of climate-related topics with our link to another site, climatecrisispolicy.org. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.